in England, and we're studying the what we have seen that as the first three generations of Protestantism had passed, when the first phase was done of the Protestant Reformation, which began in the 16th century, began when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the church door in Wittenberg, that the major Protestant countries had set up state churches. And within state churches, which means churches are supported by taxes, the clergy are paid by taxes, you have to belong to the church to hold public office, you have to belong to the church to vote, if you have a vote, you have to belong to the church to have the birth of your children recorded, to go to university, to get married, to die, and be buried, because all the church control of the churchyards. State churches are always dead. Their death is built into state churches, and you can go to Germany, which is a state church, and you have a huge building, and you'll see 500 or 600, sometimes 2,000 or 3,000, find 20 or 30 people in them. And also the Church of England in England, have huge buildings and small crowds, which is the rule of state churches. When you have this kind of spiritual deadness that state churches always create, there arises you always have people who want something better, who want the real thing, who want genuine piety, who will seek to have something dynamic. We saw it in Germany. For the benefit of our guests, I'm sort of bringing them up today to give them a context for our lecture. In Germany, there arose two major movements within the state church, not forming new churches necessarily, though some of this happened later with some of these groups. But it was an attempt by people within the state church to have a spiritually dynamic kind of religion. These pietist movement in Germany. A fellow called Spinner, and then the second generation, a fellow called Frank, who created a movement, as I said, that of genuine piety. They were concerned with missions, modern faith missions grew out of the pietist movement in Germany. And then there were the Moravians, who had such an effect on John Wesley. Now we come to England, and we see that there was a movement similar to that in England, whereas in Germany it was called pietism, in England, it's called Methodism. And a Methodist, as the term originally meant, was simply someone who was methodical in their spiritual life, who set for themselves a program of regular daily Bible study and prayer and so many hours of Christian service a week. That is, they were methodical and serious in their Christian life, and they methodically kept all the appointed prayers and ritual of the Church of England. They simply, Methodists were ones who kept the rules of the Church of England, who prayed when they were supposed to pray during the week and during the day, but who added to that their own private program, their own method, which involved personal devotions, Bible study, and service. That's where the term Methodist came from. But they were within the Church of England, and of course the movement was started in England. A fellow called William Law wrote a book called A Serious Call to the Christian Life. Serious, not quite the title. Serious Call was generally called. The full title is, since I brought it up, A Serious Call to a Holy and Devout Life, which had a tremendous impact. And then the hymns of Charles Wesley, the hymns of Charles Wesley later on, but before Charles Wesley, the hymns of Isaac Watts, and I list on page 98 of our syllabus some of the hymns that Isaac Watts wrote that we still sing. Alas, I did my Savior bleed, joy to the world when I survey the wondrous cross, such hymns as that. So that had an impact on people. That is, before Watts and Charles Wesley, there wasn't much singing in the Church of England. The only singing was usually psalms done by choirs and not done very well. And so hymns, which are religious poetry put to music, began to be sung, and this produced these more dynamic spirituality. And then John Wesley, who we looked at his early life, came onto the scene. And the two men who led the Methodist movement in England were John Wesley and Whitefield. Wesley and Whitefield. We look at Wesley now. On page 102, we're looking at the contributions of the Methodist leaders. We sort of met them. The last thing we looked at was what was the... Wesley was a scholar. He was an academic. He went to school at Oxford University, one of the colleges at Oxford University, had a master's degree, taught there, went back for a while to try to teach to help his father's local parish. He failed, went back to the college and taught. Then he tried to go to the New Kingdom of America for a while and try to be something of a missionary, went to the state of Georgia, failed, fell in love with a woman, but he couldn't marry her because he'd taken a vow of celibacy, and she married someone else, and he went home. On his way over, the ship almost sank in a storm. There were some Arabians there, these German pietists who were also coming to the New World on a mission, and they were very calm in the face of death, and he was not, and that said nothing to him. He remembered that. Went back to England, and there, in a Moravian meeting, he had his heart struck strangely warm in this meeting on Aldersgate Street, and he committed himself to the, he considered himself converted, not converted to Christ, but converted to a dynamic, powerful spiritual life, as opposed to the deadness that was characteristic of the state church. And then, but even with this, he had not found a place to preach, a way to serve. It was Whitefield who was preaching to the miners, preaching in the open air, often because the churches didn't want him to preach. The state churches shut them out. And Whitefield asked Wesley, this scholar, this man who tried twice to make it in the local church and failed both times, the man who loved books and didn't work out, he couldn't pick women. Remember, he married a wife and she wasn't worth shooting. She hated him and hid his notes, and finally, because there was a small streak of mercy in her, she left him. And he lived single the rest of his life. So here's this man who couldn't pick women and couldn't make it to the local church, who loved his books, who had a real whale of a time, even after he had his master's degree, he still didn't have his life straightened out. He hadn't found any place to put his foot down, to work out this commitment he made at Aldersgate. He finally found it when Whitefield asked him to come down to the mines in Wales and preach to the miners early in the morning before they went into those dangerous mines. And here he preached. And when he saw the tears streaking down the grimy cheeks of his hearers, his listeners, streams in the coal dust on their faces, he found out that then he knew what he wanted to do. He wanted to preach, not in the church, not in the state church, but he wanted to preach to the people where he found them. This brings us to the contribution of the Methodist leaders. John Wesley, the statement I make here is, the preaching of John Wesley constituted the longest sustained revival in the history of the church. It continued for 50 years. And I put in here in my syllabus a summary of his labors. This is sort of looking at his life as a whole. And a biographer has summarized his labors this way. The effectiveness of Wesley is irrefutable. At the end of his career, at least 70,000 Methodists lived in England alone. And you understand that in England, the Methodist society was not a church. It was not a separate church. It was a society within the state church, the Anglican church. That is, these were people who went to the state church in the mornings, usually, and went to a Methodist gathering in the evening. They went to the state church, probably because it was required by law to keep their standing and keep their civil rights, but then for their real religion, they went to the Methodist gathering. Another 70,000 had died during his career. These Methodists were shepherded by 550 itinerant preachers, most of whom Wesley himself had called out and trained. No man labored more intensely in the ministry than Wesley. He averaged 800 sermons a year, more than 15 a week. And these sermons were usually an hour and a half to 3 hours long. That was considered normal back then. Kill us today, but that was it. For 60 years, he preached to open-air throngs. Think of that. For 60 years, he preached to open-air throngs all over the British Isles. He drew immense crowds. Often 10,000 to 20,000 persons waited to hear him preach. Think about it. When it was announced, he would show up on a certain day to preach. As many as 20,000 people would be there waiting for him. This is before microphones. and tape the music. I don't see how they did it. He went wherever the population was the thickest. His missions took him into the mines, the fields, the streets, and the churches where he could get in. He rode horseback 20,000 miles a year. That's a lot of miles in a car. So he lived on his horse. Reading out of his saddlebag as he rode. I love that. There's a horse that just kept moving, and he kept a saddle. I love this man, because he was always, if he did what he really wanted to do, selfishly, he would have gone to this study and closed his door and read it. He was a scholar, a classical scholar, a brilliant scholar. He loved his books. But he felt the compulsion to preach. So he, what he did, he took his library with him. The poor horse carried, you know, the whole these books in the saddlebags. The books were heavy. In his labors, he covered more than 250,000 miles, preached more than 42,000 sermons, produced more than 200 works, and in this period, he wrote more than 200 books, not just on religion. He was a pioneer in the area of public education. He authored books in the field of education. He wrote a grammar, an English grammar, a complete English dictionary, and a concise history of England. Now think about that. Wrote a dictionary and a history of England in his spare time, you know. That's what happens when you don't get married. Or your wife.
Just him and his horse and his books. And
he was a Methodist. He was the Methodist Methodist. There was not a method to his life. He wasted no time. He used every moment. You'd have to accomplish all that. In the early days, when he would preach, his preaching was attended with spiritual manifestations of speaking in tongues and falling out and holy rolling. They didn't jump the pews because it wasn't in the church. They jumped the haystacks. But that gradually died out. And Wesley, that was from an early enthusiasm, and that died away. And Wesley was grandly hated. And I try to teach the kids here at the college that if you're really doing the work of God, you'll be spend most of your life in trouble. Every servant of God belongs in trouble. If you're not in trouble, you're probably not doing what you're supposed to be doing. I just thought I'd tell you that. And Wesley was in trouble all of his life. He was shut out of the churches. The clergy didn't like him. They were guilty. They were jealous of him. Now keep in mind, he was a Church of England clergyman. Huh? He had his credentials. And he had been an Oxford University professor. So he wasn't, he didn't just fall off the turnip truck. He was recognized as a scholar even outside the field of religion, so they couldn't really, condemn him for being uncouth or unworthy. He was ahead, intellectually ahead of almost all the clergy in England, but they shut him out of the churches. He was attacked in print, denounced from the pulpit, lampooned in the theater. They wrote plays about him, and they're making fun of him. People paid to see them. He was often attacked by mobs. Whitefield was suffered the same thing. We haven't come to Whitefield yet to talk about his method, but Whitefield was seriously injured several times. Wesley, Whitefield was more antagonistic than Wesley was, and but his life. If people would show up and throw rotten tomatoes at him, and he's preaching, and rotten eggs and tomatoes are coming at him, and he's preaching away. What was the cause of this opposition? Well, because he called for a conversion to Christ, sort of a conversion to dynamic spirituality. He called for people to make a decision, to make it. And understand, they were born into the Church of England, baptized as babies into the Church of England. See? But he called upon these people to make a personal commitment, the way he had done. And this antagonized a lot of people. They criticized other preachers, and that didn't make them too popular. Clergymen said didn't want them trespassing in their parishes, because the Church of England and the government gave certain bishops and clergymen under them rights to certain parishes, and they couldn't trespass on each other's territory. And Wesley said, "The world is my parish," a famous statement, which meant, "I'll go wherever I want to go." And he did. And he often paid for it. They criticized him for his lack of dignity. Why? Well, the official clergy says it wasn't dignified. Now keep in mind, in the church, they wore robes, had candles burning, a lot of liturgy, incense, and all this stuff, everybody loved to pray. Here he is preaching on tombstones, wagon beds, public squares. He'd just get up, wherever there's a crowd, and stand up where he could be heard. He'd stand on a wagon bed and preach. Well, a preacher ought not to do that. Why? I'll be in church where he belongs. But they wouldn't let him in the church. It's interesting. Here you see, people don't like it, they get you going or coming. They wouldn't let him in the church, and so he preached out in the haystacks, and they said, he should fellowship preach in church and preach out there. You all got that, didn't you? He rebuked sin. Now let me say, teach you something about this. This is something which people who live in our culture, including myself, cannot really understand, but it was considered the job of the preacher. Our students will remember what happened to John Knox, because he did this in Scotland earlier. The preacher was called upon to denounce sin, and they did it quite specifically. They would even name names. And they didn't use the euphemism. They called things what they were, which would shock the socks off of the modern churchgoer. Billy Sunday, even at the turn of the century, we're going to talk about him later, but he would be shut down. He would not be accepted by churches today because he was so graphic. They talk about sin. They talk about just the way it was. And Wesley more than most. He was very straightforward. And this got him in trouble. And because they led so many to a life of sobriety, the saloon keepers hated it, the liquor crowd, because liquor was in the abuse of liquor, alcoholism was endemic. It was one of the major problems, much like America today. If you want to make somebody mad, you get the liquor industry mad at you. They are a multi-billion dollar industry. They control the government. It's interesting. I'll just prove it to you. Even in America, it's always been this way. For every one person that cancer kills, liquor kills 1,000. Often it kills them more cruelly than cancer does. And yet the government will fight cancer and license liquor. Think about that. Why? There's money in liquor, there's money in cancer. And these powerful interests, people quit drinking by the thousands. And boy, the liquor people got after Wesley and Whitefield. And the saloon keepers would beat drums while he's trying to preach. Bring big barrels, drums, and beat them so people couldn't hear him. They would turn bulls loose, bring wild bulls into the crowd, turn them loose. A lot of fun going to church. They would incite mob action, get mobbed to run him off the pulpit or wherever he was preaching. And they tried, and they did everything they could to break up his public meetings. He didn't have an easy life of it. Well, the other labors of John Wesley, he has been called the busiest man in England. Besides his preaching and writing, which I've already talked about, he carried out the following activities. He formed Methodist societies, opened chapels. Now see, in England, you couldn't call it a church because church means the state church. So when they began to meet and build their own buildings, the Methodists, they were called chapels. England, that's interesting, the Methodist church in England was not a church until after it was in America, after the American Revolution. There's a Methodist church in England now. In those days it wasn't. It was a Methodist society. So they could have their chapels. That's what they called them for that reason. He examined, commissioned, and managed preachers, administered discipline, raised funds for schools, chapels, and charities, prescribed for the sick. Now, we don't think about this, but the preacher, this is before professional medicine, and the preacher was expected to know something about medicine as he traveled around to prescribe medicine. Interesting, Thomas and Alexander Campbell did this in Scotland. That was a part of the program. The preachers prescribed medicine in many cases, especially in the back country where there were no doctors. And the barbers pulled teeth. They weren't dentists. But if you get a tooth pulled, you went to the barber. He cut your hair and pulled your teeth. He superintended schools and orphanages. He wasn't very good at it. He prepared commentaries, wrote and edited a vast amount of literature for the Methodists. He replied to attacks on Methodism. He conducted debates, just like Alexander Campbell and others did later, and he carried on a prodigious correspondence with several letters a day. The famous statement is, at the death of John Wesley, he died at the age of 88, leaving behind, quote, a worn robe, a silver spoon, and the Methodist Church. Now, this isn't in your syllabus, but if you look at his journal, He talks about how he was able to do this. This is interesting, I think. How could any man preach for all those years, travel all those miles, carry on all that administrative work, organize all those societies, write all that literature, carry on all those debates, and do all that? The answer is he was a single-minded man, and he was very healthy. He said he was blessed with robust health, and he carried on the same level of work, almost at the same level, until the year of his death. He died with his boots on, as it were. He didn't lay around a lot. He worked till he was done, and he died. Which is not a bad way to go, is it? He writes, when he was in his late 80s, he writes that earlier he had preached four or five times a day, for a lot of years, and he said, somebody asked him one time why he had such good health in his old age, and this is what he wrote in his journal. May we not impute it as inferior means?
I don't say what that means, that's the old way of talking.
He said this, to my constant exercise and change of air. That's an old idea, that change of air is healthy for you.
There's a limited value in that, but
it's constant exercise. By the way, riding a horse is physically demanding. If I ever ridden horses, a lot of people think you just sit there and the horse does all the work. That's not true. I think a few things are more tiring than riding a horse, especially if you're not used to it. Constant exercise, to my never having lost a night's sleep, sick or well, at land or sea since I was born. It's a great value being able to sleep nights. So he got his sleep. To my having slept at command, so that whenever I feel myself almost worn out, I call it, that is sleep, and it comes day or night. It's a great talent. You can learn that, by the way. Sleep. Whenever you need to sleep, he's like, I need to sleep. I need to decide to go to sleep, and I go to sleep. I decide to sleep for half an hour, and I wake up. You can condition yourself to do that. It's a very valuable tool. It keeps you going. I know an old black man that I knew, who's dead now, great preacher, who's starting churches in his 80s. In his 80s, Isaiah Henry Harrison Moore, the former dean of the College of the Scriptures, a black man, one of the greatest preachers I ever heard, he could do that. He kept going, and he needed to sleep no matter where. One time, he never had to drive a car. One time, some of the young men from the college took him to the post office and drove him around. They considered it an honor to drive him around, and he didn't win me a letter. He went in, and he didn't come out, and finally got looking for him. Here he was standing up against the wall, taking a nap. He didn't have to sit down. He thought he was trying to take a nap. He was going to leave the wall and take a nap. Well, Wesley could do that, and it's very valuable.
Cool.
Listen to this. I want our students to listen to this. To having constantly, that is regularly, for about 60 years, risen at 4 in the morning. To my constant preaching at 5 in the morning for above 50 years, almost every day for 50 years, he preached at 5 o'clock in the morning. As I said before, what they would do is, he would preach to farmers and miners before they went to work. They would gather, and he would preach to them for an hour or so, and then they would go to work. To my having so little pain in my life and so little sorrow and anxious care, well, he had a lot of care, it just didn't get to him. Then he goes on to say that he's had to slow down a little recently. He's preached a couple, three times less a week.
He
got married, and his wife was made life miserable for him, and finally she left him, and he figured out. That's why he listened. He figured that was, it was, and there's the thing is, Wesley always thought himself a man who was well equipped to give people advice on picking mates. So there was one of the mysteries in his personality.
He knew what not to do.
Yeah.
He always thought, you know, you want to know how to pick a man? Let me tell you. He was so good at it.
Charles Wesley, his brother, did some outdoor preaching, but he was head of family and he couldn't move around so much, and he was not that great a preacher. But his main contribution was the hymn singing, the hymn writing. And he wrote, listen, Charles Wesley wrote 6,500 hymns in his lifetime, about 25 of which are still sung. Now let me tell you, teach you the straight of that. He didn't write 6,500 words and music. A hymn, when it says hymn back then, they meant the words. See, what they did back then, the old Methodists and other churches, the hymn books would have just the words, and the big thick hymn book would just have the words. But there would be a certain number of tunes, and the tunes would have names. So they would say, we're going to sing this hymn to this tune. And often to the same tune, you would sing many hymns, understand? Many sets of words to the same tune. Now you understand, these open air meetings, they didn't have pianos and organs. And so people had to know that. See, as long as they knew the tune, they could read the words and sing very well. Now what has happened, and often many of these hymns that you wrote were not, they were designed for special days, special, so they're very specialized. That is, he would say to his brother, John Wesley would say to his brother, this is a special service Sunday in a special place, write me a hymn for the service. And they would write a hymn for the service, just for that particular event. And people would sing it to a well-known tune, have a good song service. Now what has happened in the evolution of hymnody is that certain hymns have become
really attached to certain tunes. So now, in our churches, we associate certain hymns with certain tunes. And if someone gives us music, we can recall the words. But even Jeff, we still do one small church. You ever sing, take the words from one hymn and sing it to the message of the music of another, if it fits. And then, well, I think we ought to do more of that, but that was the old custom. So so what I'm trying to teach you is when it says he wrote 6,500 hymns, that doesn't mean he wrote 6,500 sets of words and music. That means he wrote 6,500 sets of words and a few tunes. Quite a few. There weren't just a small number, but quite a few tunes. And some of these tunes have come down. And you see this in your hymn books, the words by one person, tuned by another. If you're interested in this, as a footnote to this, a good many in America, in the American frontier, where there was not a lot of musical expertise, Americans ran short on tunes. And American churches, during the frontier period, developed a habit of taking tunes from the saloons, from the bars, taking barroom tunes, and putting Christian words to them. Some of our old favorite hymns we seem to sing in the church for two generations now were written in barroom tunes. Well, I give you the song, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, is an old hymn. The tune is an old English drinking song. I'll tell you that. It was an old English drinking song, and then there was an American version, John Brown's Body Lies a Smoldering in the Dust. And whoever wrote it was picked up as the words of the Battle of the Republic were put to it, and that's how we remember it. But it's funny, sometimes American evangelists, this has happened before they come in, before they realize this, like when Billy Graham, the Crusades, and Dwight L. Moody would go to England, they would take their musicians along, and they would sing some of these songs. The British had a real problem with some of those tunes because they grew up singing in the saloon. Now they're singing in the church to different words. They had a tough time thinking about God when they were remembering, their drinking buddies. But anyway. I put it myself with some of the songs of Charles Wesley that we still use. Love Divine, All Loves Excelling Should Be. Love Divine, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, Christmas, Charles Wesley. Oh, one of my favorites. Oh, for a thousand tongues to... That's a great song. Great tune, too. Oh, for a thousand tongues to sing my great Redeemer's praise. And Jesus, lover of my soul, let me to thy bosom fly. You recognize those? At least one or two of them. We sang them. You probably know them. We won't take time. George Whitefield, we come down to George Whitefield, his preaching. He was the most eloquent preacher of the three. And he had the greatest direct results of his preaching. It's interesting, Whitefield had the greatest results, but Wesley preached longer and more. And with it, so, in other words, during the years when both of them were preaching full time, Whitefield had the greatest results, but he didn't last as long. His health was not as good, for one thing. And Whitefield was one of the first ones to do what we call emotional preaching. I mean, he'd laugh and tell funny stories. That was considered heresy. He'd cry, and he'd tell sad stories, and he frankly appealed to the emotions, and had quite an effect. He was the best show in town many cases. Whereas Wesley preached primarily to the poor, Whitefield preached not only to the poor, but also to the upper classes. Whitefield was more acceptable to the upper classes than Wesley was. So most of the upper class people, the more wealthy people, the better educated people who came into the Methodist Church came through Whitefield, not Wesley. Whereas Wesley stayed in Great Britain, Whitefield made 7 trips to America, and we're going to meet him again when we talk about the Great Awakening in America. Whitefield created the Evangelical Party. We're going to talk about this later, but it was Whitefield, because he reached the upper classes, he converted people to what they called evangelical Christianity, who became the leaders in England, and they were the ones who reformed England. We're going to meet the people, such as Wilberforce and others, who abolished slavery and reformed child labor and cleaned up the mental institutions and established schools. These were these evangelicals who were converts of George Whitefield.
Let me just say this because we have a number of guests with us today. The general impression is given in public education, I know because I've read the books, is that somehow Christianity is parasitic. That is, Christianity, you pick up a lot of modern textbooks, and for all practical purposes, you get the impression the church never really existed, or if it did exist, it does not play an important role in society. I want to say to our students that Western civilization is a product of the church. It lives off of us. If it were not for the church, there would be slavery. We still have children working, 5-year-old children working 15 hours a day in the mines. If it were not for the church, there would be no universities, there would be no public schools, there would be no hospitals, there would be no mental institutions. Our prisons would be dungeons. If it were not for the church, you would not want to live, the Western civilization would not exist, and you would not want to live in this world. So never forget that. It was the influence of the gospel that changed England and had such an effect. And note this, if you trace the influence back, and I'll say this to those who are considering going to Bible college, when nations reform themselves and life in Western civilization, especially England and America, they developed political systems that were based upon such ideas as freedom and justice. Were simple notions. If you trace them back to where those ideas came from, who is to be credited? To whom do we owe the great debt? You'll always find a preacher. It's a preacher. Preaching is where it's at. See, society, civilization, political systems, world governments, everything stands or falls ultimately on the presence or absence of. And when you take the preaching out, all you're left with is Berlin walls, iron curtains, concentration camps, and misery. Very serious stuff. Just trace it back. Think of that. White was a preacher, and he changed people's lives, and people changed Western civilization. It all went back to the preacher. If there's anything more important in this world that goes on than preaching. And it was true then, it's true now. Well, that was there. When we trace the reform, understand? Reform movement in England. It's interesting. I'll just digress here. France. Now, England was in a mess. So the white people message started preaching. England was on the verge of revolt. The Industrial Revolution had made life miserable. So we're talking later about child labor, about slavery in the British Isles and in the British colonies. It was terrible. There was no public education. Life was short. Miserable people were diseased, ignorant, until John Wesley and George White began to preach. England, France was in the same mess. They looked north across the English Channel, and they saw what was happening in England, and they wanted to reform their country too, because they had the same problems. Life was miserable in France. But they didn't want preaching. You see, France, our students studied this, France killed all their preachers. They were called Huguenots, killed all their Protestants. Drove them out, brought them into America. The heroes of France were not Whitefield and West, they were men like them. The heroes of France were Voltaire and Rousseau, the atheists. And so they said, we're going to clean up our country, we're going to do it without the gospel, we're going to do it without preachers. And you know what they got? They got the guillotine, they got one of the greatest bloodbaths in history, and they got a dictator named Napoleon out of it. That's what they got out of it. It didn't work, you understand? They lost their freedom, and they almost destroyed their country. So you can either have preaching, or you can have a dictatorship, because the ideas of freedom and justice grow out of the gospel, and they don't come from any other place. And it's not simply logic that teaches us this, it's history. When it changes the world, preach. Everything else is secondary. That's my sermon for the day. Well, now I have to pick up an offering. Because Whitefield was not an organizer, and Wesley was, there was no permanent society. That is, it was not Whitefield who organized the Methodist Church, it was Wesley. So Whitefield's movement kind of died out as an organized movement when he went out of business. His health broke, he couldn't preach as much, but he made tremendous influence, made a tremendous contribution.
Look now to the organization of the Methodist. Any questions before I go on? Well, we've already said that Wesley organized the Methodist Church. He had no idea of forming a church, as we've said. It was a society within the Church of England. But eventually it became a church, and I trace in the syllabus here the steps of this. They formed societies patterned after the Moravians. Wesley was always heavily influenced by the Moravians. So they formed societies, and these societies were organized into classes were formed, organized into societies. These were about a dozen people under a leader. And interestingly enough, the idea of the small group movement, Wesley was the founder of that, and by accident it was ideally suited for the American frontier. That is, you didn't need a big church or a bishop or anything. All you need was a teacher and class. And when it got too big, you divided, got another teacher, formed another class, and these classes, these Methodist classes, eventually formed churches. Before the Civil War, the Methodist Church was the largest church in America. One of the reasons was that their way of growing was small classes with moderately trained leaders. Plus, it was ideally designed for the frontier, yes.
What's their idea of small classes?
12 people, 10 to 12 people. You see, now their preachers were called lay preachers. In England, they were not clergymen. They could not be ordained. Why? Because nobody could be ordained but a member of the Church of England. And he didn't want Anglican clergymen, wanted ordinary fellows. And so he trained these people. He gave these lay preachers a simple course in preaching. And then he oversaw their work. Now, the Methodist Church, although it's changing now some in the latter years, the Methodist Church always had the tradition of shifting their preachers every 3 or 4 years. This started with John Wesley. He said he would give a man a circuit of classes or societies to preach in, a circuit ride preaching. That was designed, worked very well on the frontier when it was transferred to America. He would train him as best he could, and he would give him a circuit. On a certain day, he was supposed to preach here. On Thursday, he was supposed to preach here. On Saturday, he was supposed to preach here. He traveled around. And he would give him that circuit about 3 years. He figured 3 years, he had told those people all he knew. Probably repeated himself, so he switched them. They didn't switch circuits. And the Methodist Church sustained that habit with the idea that, you know, the preacher would sort of shoot his wad in 2 or 3 years, and he's switching, and then go preach somewhere else. Here's an excerpt from one of his letters I put in my syllabus to one of his lay preachers. He's writing to one of these young men he's trained to run this, to preach at all these societies scattered over England. Dear John, always take, and this is, I put this in because we have here in this college older preachers training younger preachers. This is good advice. Dear John, always take advice or reproof as a favor. Somebody criticizes you, listen to them. Don't get insulted. It is the surest mark of love. I advised you once, and you took it as an affront. I tried to give you some advice on your preaching, and you got offended, so I'm telling you to take advice. That's good advice, by the way, students. Take advice. Nevertheless, I'll do it once more. Scream now like this. Scream no more at the peril of your soul. He was getting up and screaming to the people. Preaching to the top. You ever heard a preacher like that? He starts out in high gear, you know, he's just screaming at him. He says, scream no more at the peril of your soul. I had an associate minister one time, I had to tell that too. Speak as earnestly as you can, but do not scream. Speak with all your heart, but with a moderate voice. Be a follower of me. I often speak loud, often vehemently, but I never scream. I love that. On our list here, and we'll close with this today, some of Wesley's rules for the preacher. And this is good advice. That's why, because we're a preacher training institution, I put these in the syllabus. Number one, never disappoint a congregation except in cases of life and death. That is, see, these fellows had appointments lined up 2 or 3 months ahead of time. If you're supposed to be there to preach, be there. Show up, and show up on time. Second, begin and end precisely at the time appointed. See, keep an eye, he was preaching to men had to go to work. Yeah. Begin when you're going to begin, they let people show up and you end on time so they could go about their business. Choose the plainest text you can. Don't try to get fancy. Take care not to ramble, but keep to your text. I can get some chapel speakers we've had in the last 2 or 3 years to give that advice to. Take care not to ramble, but keep to your text. Be sparing in allegorizing or spiritualizing.
Make sure the text, you'll spiritualize the text to say something it doesn't say.
Do not, I love this one. Do not usually, talk about public prayer now, leading prayer. Do not usually pray more than 8 or 10 minutes at most without intermission. Listen, in those days, a 30-minute public prayer was considered standard. He says, don't preach that long, 8 or 10 minutes, I mean, don't pray that long, 8 or 10 minutes, that's long enough, without intermission. Sing a song, and then, you know, stop, sing a song, and then start again, if you're going to pray that long. Avoid quaint words, however, in fashion. By quaint, he means slangy street words. Beware of clownishness, whether in speech or dress. Wear no slouch hat.
That is considered rakish or clownish. Make sure your hat is not slouched. Don't dress like a vacuum cleaner salesman from Dubuque, Iowa. Something like that. Dress like a gentleman. Be merciful to your beast. That means take care of. What's that? Be merciful to your beast. Not only ride moderately, don't ride your horse to death, but see with your own eyes that your horse be rubbed, fed, and bedded. You make sure you stop at night, make it your personal responsibility that your horse is, you want rubbed, fed, and bedded so your horse will stay alive.
Yeah.
Be diligent. Never, now, I don't know if this is, remember all the works he did, all the sermons he preached, and the books he wrote, and the things he organized, how can any man do so much? Here's why. Be diligent, never be unemployed a moment. Boy, he wasn't. Never be triflingly employed. Make sure you always be doing something, and always be doing something important. Never while away time. He would have hated television and crossword puzzles. And girls. Just kidding about that. Listen, I like this. Spend no more time at any place than is strictly necessary. Don't hang around. Be serious. Avoid all lightness, jesting, and foolish talk. You strictly business. Converse, that is talk, sparingly and cautiously with women, particularly with young women. Amen. That'll get you talking. I like this. Take no step toward marriage without first consulting your brother. Well, he had received twice advice from his brother, and it was rotten advice both times. But he thought it was a good idea. Before you get married, ask somebody else. Believe evil of no one unless you see it done. People come carrying, this is good. You get in the local church, you're going to hear stories all the time. Believe nothing until you know it for a fact. Believe evil of no one unless you see it with your own eyes. That's good advice. Speak evil of no one. I like this one. Tell everyone plainly what you think wrong in him. What a rotten potato's got thrown at him on that. If you think a fellow is sinning, needs to be straightened up, you have a responsibility to tell him. Now keep in mind, in those days, people expected the preacher to do that, as I said earlier, and they would not normally take offense at it. Today, he takes his life in his hands if he does that. I like this one. Do not affect the gentleman. You have no more to do with his character than that of a dancing master. Now, a gentleman, a gentleman then didn't mean what it does now. Today, a gentleman.